Spent about a half hour, roughly, working through Division of Family Youth Services, DFYS. Commissioner, would you mind, let's just let Pat sit up here just by herself for a little bit here. She's going to have to make her presentation, and we need to talk. We need to talk with her. I don't want you on the hot seat with her. You've got your own to deal with. Last year, there were many news stories and lots of hard work here in the legislature and in the administration on the question of child protection. There was an audit, several audits have been done, and recommendations had been made in those audits. We recently had released another audit, a follow-up by our Division of Legislative Audit, and there are two recommendations from the audit a year ago that we wanted to really focus in on today and find out kind of what's happened with those recommendations. And I've invited first Pat Davidson, our legislative auditor, to lay the foundation for us from a factual perspective of what the earlier audit found, what this current audit found with respect to those two recommendations. We're not going to go through necessarily all of the audit findings unless it's related to those items. If you could help us lay the foundation for our understanding, Pat, and then we'll have Commissioner Perdue join us. And we also have some testimony. We have two individuals who wanted to testify today following those. And the one person, Nancy Wilkinson, may not be online as she was having some traveling difficulties, but faxed in her testimony for inclusion in the record. There may be another person who will be online here. So with that, Pat, if you could go ahead and lay the foundation for us to understand kind of where we are today from a ledge audit perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our most recent involvement with the Division of Family and Youth Services began in January of 1998. At that time, we initiated an audit of DFYS with five objectives. First, to evaluate how effectively DFYS management utilized FY97 personal services funding to maintain agency staffing levels, to adequately address and respond to reports of harm. Secondly, to evaluate how effectively and consistently DFYS met timelines established either by statute or the agency's internal policies with regard to investigating and responding to reports of child abuse and neglect. Third, to identify factors and circumstances which inhibited DFYS's ability to effectively respond to reports of harm. Fourth, to identify the degree to which DFYS was unable to respond to reports of harm, and to evaluate the effect of not responding may have on child safety. And finally, to assess the impact of recent changes in federal law and proposed state legislation on the state's child protection system. Our conclusions from that March report were that in FY97, DFYS did not investigate more than 3,700 reports of harm. We believe that while DFYS's triage response to reports of harm is risk-based, it does still leave some children at risk. We found that DFYS social workers did not consistently meet the required ongoing contact standards. We found that DFYS did not fully utilize its funding received during FY97. We found the lack of specificity in the statute limited DFYS's authority to terminate parental rights. And we found that DFYS staff training efforts had suffered from a lack of coordination, consistency, and funding. Based on our work and the conclusions of this audit, we made eight recommendations, as Chairman indicated. First was that the legislature should consider additional funding for social worker positions. Secondly, if the legislature did provide that funding, that the Commissioner of Health and Social Services should report the effects of that funding back to the legislature. The legislature should consider amending relevant child protection statutes to provide for a framework of better case and more consistent casework management. We found that the Director of Administrative Services should ensure that expenditures for the Retirement Incentive Program are made in accordance with legislative appropriations. The Director of DFYS should develop and implement a clear and consistent policy regarding when reports of harm should be left uninvestigated. We believe that DFYS should develop an updated, accurate, and relevant workload measurement model. That efforts should be made to integrate professional development and training programs in conjunction with the University of Alaska. And that finally, DFYS should ensure accurate and timely entry of child protection case information into its management information system. After that audit was released, the Budget and Audit Committee authorized a follow-up audit be conducted to determine the degree to which implementation of those recommendations were made. The follow-up audit was released earlier this month. The conclusions of that report are that the legislature provided funding for additional 28 social worker positions. In our review of the investigation statistics, we found that there was an overall drop of 4% in the rate of investigations for the first 4 months of FY99 compared with the prior year. In Anchorage, that drop was 11%. We believe that two management decisions contributed to the decrease in the number of reports of harm being investigated. One was a decision relating to the promotion and transfers, which contributed to an inexperienced staff managing the Anchorage intake unit, and a more aggressive use of workload adjusting was adopted in the Anchorage intake unit.
Pat, before you move on, would you explain that word workload adjusting for us and for the viewers too?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The workload adjust is an informal policy to delay or never investigate reports of harm that are determined to be of a lower risk. If an agency has more incoming workloads, they need to identify those that they can handle, work on those, and the other ones are set aside. That general policy is referred to as workload adjusting.
Thank you.
In terms of the specific status of prior recommendations, the legislature authorized funding for additional 28 social worker positions, and most of these positions were filled in September and October of 98. The legislation amending and strengthening child protection services became effective September 14th of 1998. This statute was strengthened by describing parental behaviors that may be considered abandonment or neglect, rather than requiring the social worker to determine whether the child is in imminent danger of substantial physical harm. We found no evidence that any funds were used in FY98 inappropriately to pay for retirement incentive program costs. We find that DFYS is still unable to investigate each report of harm. Therefore, there is a continuing need to allocate available resources responsibly, and we continue to recommend that DFYS develop a usable and reliable workload measurement tool. In addition, any expansion or further implementation of an agency-wide consistently applied workload adjusting methodology should be coupled with a valid workload measurement tool. The FYS has made significant progress to provide professional development and training for staff. In our previous review, we identified several deficiencies in the agency's case management system. During the current audit, additional errors were identified, and therefore we continue to recommend that DFYS correct, upgrade, or replace its current management information system. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my prepared remarks.
Yeah, before you go on, or before we open to questions, at page 22 of the audit that was released in March of this year, the two recommendations from a year ago, number 5 and number 8, those are the two that we wanted to focus on this morning. Can you explain the recommendation again of number 5, which was that the director of DFYS should develop and implement a clear and consistent policy regarding when reports of harm can be left uninvestigated? And then number 8, the director of DFYS should develop an updated, accurate, and relevant workload measurement model. Could you just focus us in on those two, because you've kind of given us the broad brush. Tell us again what the audit found with respect to number 5 and what you're trying to accomplish with that recommendation, and the same with number 8.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. When an agency is faced with a workload that funding doesn't allow them to address 100%, some decisions need to be made in terms of what are priorities. The way that you would like an agency to respond to those develop those priorities is understanding which are the most important, which are the least important. Those are very difficult decisions, and those are decisions that management should make or give direction to the staff with regard to. So when we talk about a clear and consistent policy with regard to which reports of harm can be left uninvestigated, what we're asking management to do is to define those risk factors, put in a risk assessment tool, whatever, so that staff understand clearly what those, what the policy is. Again, I stress it is a very difficult decision to make, and therefore we believe that it's management's responsibility and shouldn't be left to an individual social worker.
Is that so that, for instance, in one community, some reports of harm would be left uninvestigated, where in another community they would be investigated? Is that where you're talking about the inconsistency?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And that falls in line with the number 8 recommendation with regard to the workload measurement model. If you're looking for staff, this is a very large agency. There's a lot of staff involved. And whether each office is appropriately staffed, what we're recommending that they do is develop a workload measurement tool so that they know what does the standard take, how much time does a standard report of harm, if it has to do with physical abuse or neglect, so that they can understand across each of the agencies what the workload is. And those two things coupled together, I believe, are some of the issues that the division needs to address in being able to respond more effectively.
You first made those recommendations a year ago, and then you followed up with this. What progress did you know the department made towards those two recommendations?
Mr. Chairman, specifically related to those, we found no substantial progress on those.
Okay. Senator Phillips.
Chairman, so the committee understands this is the we had an audit release in April of 1998 with these 8 recommendations. Later on, during the year, we had a follow-up on these 8 recommendations, and that's what we're reviewing. We also have another audit that was released in January this year, and we'll have another follow-up to that audit with another 6 recommendations. So we're dealing with just 8 here. Mr. Chairman, also, I'm concerned, actually, the engine for this whole audit is recommendations 5, 8, and also I would like to have Pat Davidson comment on recommendation number 7, which will be on 24, top of page 24 of your follow-up audit.
Could you discuss your recommendation number 7 from a year ago? It's on page 24 of the March release.
Yes, it does fall in line with the recommendations I just discussed in terms of getting a handle on a workload. Social services agencies are always trying to deal with workload possibly more than their funding allows. So the ability to respond to the most urgent is always critical. And understanding how to respond to those, we believe, will be enhanced with a better management information system. And it will allow management to be able to monitor without doing individual looks at individual cases to be able to evaluate the overall statistics, the workload, how things are flowing from a summary basis. And until you get those things factored in, until that information is readily available and it is reliable, management is in a difficult position being able to manage the staff and the work of the agency.
Senator Phillips?
Just a comment. If you look at the bottom, the division's legislative audits recommendations, we continue to recommend that DFYS correct, upgrade, or replace the current case management system. But, Mr. Chairman, those are the 3 recommendations, 5, 7, and 8, are the ones I'm going to be concentrating on. Because I do believe this is the engine that drives the whole program for the FYS, and we need to make sure that the division is following up on these recommendations made by our legislative auditors back in April.
Any further questions for Pat Davidson? Pat, before you go, the audit kind of takes things in more sterile government terms, in the sense that DFYS, the recommendation was DFYS should develop and implement a clear and consistent policy regarding when reports of harm can be left uninvestigated. What does that mean practically for child protection in Alaska when we don't have a clear and consistent policy regarding when reports of harm can be left uninvestigated? Because that's what this really gets down to.
Mr. Chairman,
Yes.
Does it mean more children are at risk, Pat?
Basically, yes. You don't have, it could be the children left at risk are those that are lower priority cases. But until you give clear direction and make, focus your resources on those that are most important, children that are at a, possibly at a lesser risk, there's been one report of harm of a child not attending school as somebody's concerned. But if you get a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth report like that, the agency needs to be able to recognize and respond. So, yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions for Pat? Thank you very much. Commissioner, could you join us, please? Do you have anybody else you'd like to join?
Mind if I bring up Rustin?
That's fine. Sure. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Karen Perdue, Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and with me is Russ Webb, Deputy Commissioner of the Department, Teresa Snorri, who's our Child Protection Chief. And we have provided the committee with a few charts, and we're not going to go through lots of detail, but I'd like to just talk from this chart first and give you a sense of perspective about how much work has been done over the last year. Senator Phillips points out, if you look at the timeline on the bottom, the first audit, we've had three audits in the last year, two full audits and one follow-up audit. The first audit was completed in April of 98. Eight recommendations were released at that time. We have completed or substantially completed five, and three do remain, the three that you mentioned. One of the most important recommendations in the audit was the enactment of House Bill 375. And that's a very big piece of legislation, and we are working very hard on implementing that law. We did receive our 28 positions, and not to go into too much detail, but to say that we spent most of the summer hiring, setting up our training system, which was asked for in the audit, training our workers and training attorneys and training judges on the law. The follow-up period for the first audit began the auditors actually arrived back in November to check on our progress, but we're needing to use the data back to July to check on our progress. Basically, we didn't get our workers fully trained and hired until January. As you can see there, January 99 is when all our new workers began carrying full caseloads. So we're going to start to see the effects, and in fact, we have in our January data seen the effects of the new workers on some of the factors that Pat discussed. We also, during this time, had another full-blown audit that was occurring, audit number two, which was a very intensive case audit. So we feel we know the auditors well, and we are certainly working with them. I want to go up to the charts on the top for a minute and give you a sense of progress that has been made, because I think it has been tremendous. If you look at the reports of harm chart, which is the chart on the right, you can see that if you look not month to month, but over a period of July 96 to January of 99, that we have made a trend of progress in answering the phone calls that come into our office. And this is a statewide number, so that it averages out for parts of the state where things are going better and things are going worse. But in January, when we finally saw the effects of some of the workers, we received and achieved an all-time high of answering 85% of all our calls. That really feels good to us. But there's a lot of good news inside that I just want to give you a second about. We have 30 offices, and in virtually every office, our performance has improved dramatically in answering the call. An example, in MAP 2, we've gone from about 39% of the calls answered to 50%, which isn't up to our statewide average that we'd like to be at, nowhere near where Anchorage is, but tremendous progress. We have major progress in Ketchikan. In January in Ketchikan, every report of harm was answered, and that feels really good. Fairbanks took a dip over the summer because of training issues, as that Anchorage did, but now it has increased. Kenai has increased. Juneau has increased. So, you know, every place is increasing. What happens is when Anchorage has a blip, because there are half the kids there, the numbers in the state either go way up or go down, depending on what's happening in Anchorage. The same time, we've seen an increase in the other part of the business we're doing, which is the children in state custody and the number of families receiving ongoing services. We really believe that with the new workers that you gave us, and if we can make more progress on workers, that we will start to see the children in custody coming down, because we will comply with the new law, which asks us to act faster. And that's very, very good to get. So now let me turn quickly to the audit, because I know that's your issue at this time.
I think, Commissioner, before you go on, going back to that reports of harm graph that you showed
us,
percentage assigned for investigation. So what you're saying there is that we took in more phone calls, we answered more phone calls, and more cases were assigned to child protection workers for investigation. More reports of harm were turned over. Is that what's increasing here?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that the percentage of the calls that we are getting we're assigning more of. So the numbers go up and down. The raw numbers go up and down every month. And I believe me, I struggled with this. And I think over the long term, the best way to handle this is to deal with the percentages.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, because at page 12 of the audit, where you get the numbers of investigative reports of harm, I'm trying to distinguish what you're graphing here vis-a-vis what's on the graph in the audit, because the number of investigated reports of harm are way down in Anchorage. But it looks like from the graph, you're assigning more that are not being investigated. I mean, that's what is seeming to appear here.
Yeah, it's two different ways of measuring it. But you remember that we, the number of calls that we get go up and down every month, and also the kinds of cases that come in are different. One month you might have more what we would call priority ones, and I want to go over the priority system in a minute, and the cases take longer to investigate. There are faster response times. Also, we substantiate about 50% of the calls that we investigate, and substantiation cases tend to take longer.
So is the percentage of reports of harm investigated, are you still using that as a solid measure of agency operations, or are you now focusing on percentage assigned for investigation, or is it both?
It's percentage assigned for investigation, which is the same as the top chart on page 12.
Well,
I see what you're saying. It's the same. Yes.
Okay, those are the same numbers as the
yes.
top chart on page. Okay, thank you
yes.
much.
You know, I think that Pat has a point about the absolute numbers, and of course the issue is, as the auditors point out, Anchorage. And let me just give you a brief update on Anchorage. We made the decision after the audit that we needed to focus on training, because we had too big a turnover in our staff. You know, we have to treat our staff well if they're going to stay with us. What happened in Anchorage is the workers made a very big push in 98 to answer all kinds of calls. And they were getting an investigation assigned to them every 3.5 hours. And if you think about that, they have to go out and actually see the child, you know, do collateral contact, et cetera. And that's just humanly impossible to do. And we lost some workers. We also, some of our workers transferred into a promotion as we got new opportunities opening up to them. So when we decided to take proactive control of the Anchorage situation, we started with reduced caseloads for these workers and brought them on a gradual upswing. And what I'd like to draw your attention to is this paper that I've handed out. And it kind of, I'm not going to go through all the details, but it kind of gives you a sense if you see the arrow. Because we've opened our training academy, because we have such a strong investment in training now, it takes about 14 and a half weeks for a worker to come up to full caseload. And so that's where we are now. That's why in January, you're seeing the numbers, I think, doing a little bit better, quite a bit better, actually. Let me just, before I go on to 5 and 8, I just want to talk to you a little bit about this law. It is a big deal. You know, I've worked on another big law, the welfare reform law, and it's as big as that. It has systemic change. And when the auditors came in October and November, I think we were starting to realize the changes, but now we're really feeling them, and we like the law. But it's tremendously impacting the work we do, because we have to move faster, and that's good for the kids. So, for instance, on adjudication hearings, in February of the year before, there were no adjudication hearings. In this February, there were 44 adjudication hearings in Anchorage. So it gives you a sense of the amount of work that's being done. And that means that people get the day in court, kids don't linger in foster care, etc. So we are really focused on implementing this law. And if we don't do that, in about a year, somebody's going to order an audit of us and say, how can we implement this law? So I really feel good about the law. And by the way, when I looked at the performance measures that we worked on, Mr. Chairman, last year, you worked on with Russ and Teresa, the performance measures and the missions and measures in our budget are very close to the tracking of what we'll be able to measure whether we're being successful in our law. So we really like those, and I think we ought to try to use those more for measuring success. Training, we've had workers that have paid for their own training. We've had workers frustrated with us because they can't get the specialized training they need, and we've got to continue to do that, or we're just going to have people leaving us and the expense of replacing them.
Commissioner, we budgeted training last year, did we not? Was it inadequate, or was it?
Training is going well for core training, and we we've opened our academy in Anchorage, and every worker now is getting training at the base. Now we're faced with the issue of specialized training, training on sexual abuse investigation, training on ICWA, training on Munchausen syndrome by proxy, shaken baby syndrome. You know, those specialized trainings that workers need to make really tough decisions.
I'm just going to speak from memory, so you have to correct me if I'm wrong, but as of January, I mean, that training money, $600,000 roughly, as I recall, it had not been encumbered for training. It was recently encumbered in the last month or so. I mean, why hasn't, if training is such a big issue, why are we 6 months into it without encumbering the money?
I think it has to do with an RSA thing with the university, but I can assure you that the training is occurring and that somehow the professors are being paid. I don't quite know how, but they haven't called.
How long has the training been ongoing that you're talking about here?
We opened our academy in August.
I just didn't want an impression left that there was no money for training and you can't.
No, there was a good amount of money for training, and I think that's going to pay off for us.
Okay, thank you.
On to the issue of 5 and 8. I think we don't disagree with any of these recommendations. I think we concur with all of them. I think we've prioritized how we've gotten to them. And so 5 and 8 are on our work plan here. And I just wanted to go over to the committee. I've attached in the back page a chart that kind of gives you a sense of what we're talking about. Now, this is the handout I have with the arrow. And in the back page is the priorities, how we prioritize cases. We do have a policy on prioritizing. And we put this in place a number of years ago because we couldn't go out on all the calls. So we're continuing to focus on what we call the priority ones and priority twos. And those are, we have to go out on quite quickly, and you can see that you would agree that a lot of these things have to be checked out right away. The priority threes are the ones which involve what we typically call neglect. The kids don't have food, they don't have supervision, they're coming to school, it looks like they're not being cared for at home. And these are the ones that typically have been what we call workload adjusted. And it is very true that different offices are doing it at different rates, and that's been historically true. In Anchorage, we've investigated over 85% of what comes in. In MATSU, it was 39%.
I guess the question, Commissioner, is that appropriate? In other words,
it's not appropriate. And that's why we have been trying to move towards bringing everybody up to a level where we're investigating those things that we think are of a concern. But we can't get there overnight because when we add workers for the investigation unit, we have to add workers to do something if we take kids into custody. We can't just only investigate cases.
Is the auditor's conclusion correct that to date there is no clear and consistent policy regarding when reports of harm can be left uninvestigated, or has that changed?
Well, I think we have a policy. I think we can improve it. I think there's a debate, and it's well documented in the audit, about the issue of quality versus quantity. And that's the issue we ran into in Anchorage, where we can't ask people to investigate two cases a day if they're complicated. So I think we do have a policy, but I think we need to refine it and fix it. And since the auditors finished their work in January and March, Teresa has started that work with our supervisors. And what we've done, she actually started by spending 2 days handing out reports of harm all around the table to all these different people and asking them to rate how would you rate this call? Because nothing comes in simple. You know, the cases are, the stories are pretty complicated, and unless somebody is actually, you know, the children are being tortured, and somebody calls and says, my neighbor's child is being tortured, you know, it's a subtle rating. So one issue that we have to deal with is everybody rating, using the same information to rate a priority 1, 2, and 3?
And do you have that in place now?
We are working on that. We are working on getting it.
Teresa, could you help us out here in terms of what's actually happening with that? Sorry, Senator Phillips has a similar question.
Is this the current procedure? And it says March, or it says the 1998 version. Okay, when was this implemented?
Senator, for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Russ Webb. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Senator, this is from the March audit of last year.
Right.
It's a way to display the policy that's been in place for
many years. So basically you had something set up a year ago, right?
It has been in place for many years.
Okay. Now, we got an audit right here. It says the director, DFYS, should develop and implement a clear and consistent policy regarding when ROH, reports of harm, can be left uninvestigated. Do you have such a beast or an update of this right now?
So we have a policy. The difficulty is the applying that policy, as the Commissioner said, and
Teresa. We're running short on time here, and we wanted to keep this moving as fast as possible. I'm developing a balanced budget plan for the long term and for the short term. It's critical to identify underlying assumptions that we can come to an agreement on between the public, between ourselves, the legislators, between the administration. And to help us do that this morning with respect to oil prices and production and some other items, we've got Commissioner Condon of the Department of Revenue. We also have online Ken Boyd for a little bit later presentation from Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Wilson Condon, Commissioner of Revenue, and I'll just have a few very brief comments. Our spring forecast is going to be completed and released beginning of next week. The oil price forecast that accompanies that overall forecast of state revenue will be consistent with what you heard last week from Cambridge Energy and the Energy Information Administration, that the average price that we would expect to see over the time through fiscal year 2003, that five-year period, is going to be roughly $14.50 a barrel. With the fall production volume forecast that we make ourselves, and it's consistent with the volume forecast I believe you're going to hear from the Department of Natural Resources, that means that over the next 5 years, the expected revenue that we have called general fund revenue in the past will be somewhere between $1.35 billion and $1.4 billion over the next 5 years. We'll obviously have some up years and some down years, but that's what we expect as an average over that time period. I passed out a little two-page handout that presents some information that may be helpful in your thinking about this. If we're right with respect to the price, and we have a $14.50 average, some up periods and some down periods over the next 4.5 years, we would expect to see the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund exhausted if we continue to use it precisely the way we've used it up to this moment in December 2002. If prices average $16.50, and again, the other assumption is a budget level in both of these, but on the assumption that you move forward with the announced cut plan that the majorities in both houses have announced, then that's when we would see the Constitution Budget Reserve exhausted at a $14.50 oil price, and at $16.50, that changes by 9 months to September 2003.
Commissioner,
yes.
On this line item that you've labeled Majority's Budget Cut Plan, which are you referring to, the five-year plan that we're currently involved in, or are you implementing cuts there that have been announced by?
No, that's the five-year for the $40 million this year, $30 million next year.
Okay, thank you.
And the second page is just to draw your attention to how to think about this, if prices are better or prices are worse. And what this page depicts is how much difference a $1 price change or value change in Alaska North Slope crude makes in terms of revenue availability. And for this fiscal year 1999, a dollar change up or down was worth $90 million in terms of state revenue. And for fiscal year 2000, we believe it'll be worth $70 million. And that difference is accounted for mostly by decline in production, but also some other changes, the substitution of oil that's taxed at a very low rate for oil that's taxed at a relatively higher rate in terms of the change in the production mix. As you can see, back in 1990, a $1 change meant $145 million in general fund revenue. So from 1990 to 2000, we've had a decline of more than 50%. And so if oil prices are $2 a year higher than we forecast, there'll be $140 million more available. If they're $2 lower than we forecast, there'll be $140 million less. We believe that the steep decline in this number, the revenue for $1 up or down change is not going to decline so steeply after FY 2000, but nevertheless, as a consequence of anticipated production decline, it is still going to decline. So a dollar change, the punchline is a dollar change is worth less than half as much to us as it was back in 1990. And so that's where we are today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Torgerson.
A couple questions, Commissioner. Are you saying that, I know you haven't released your revenue forecast yet, but is the 1450 what you anticipate using for FY00 for all of
No, 1450 is what we will arrive at it within a couple of dimes either way, as an average over 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003.
And the other thing, Commissioners, as you know, we're working on a look at our budget on a 20-year time frame. Any help in what you would use for outward years past 03 or a formula? I think initially you took inflation and was adjusting a price by inflation. Is there something that we can, a defendable assumption that we can use for outward price of oil in these plans that we're working on?
Well, my staff tells me that we should still anticipate that oil prices will increase with inflation going forward, and they well may. If history is a guide, then you would question that conclusion, because since the oil prices crashed at the end of 1985 and the beginning of 1986, we've had oil prices averaging, Alaska North Slope crude prices averaging about $16 a barrel in nominal terms. And as inflation has, and we've certainly had inflation since 1986, but that inflation has not been reflected in oil prices. They've remained relatively constant, with some obviously severe declines and some nice spikes up, but on average, they have been $16 a barrel. My staff tells me, but that will change. And I'll simply communicate that on and say that, you know, if I participate in the sessions in which we forecast future prices, I tend to be topping my own two bits worth into the average, I'm on the low side.
That wasn't much help.
Well, I think
roll your own here.
Let me ask a follow-up question, Commissioner. If
you know what I believe in that if you take $16 a barrel ahead in nominal terms, it's going to be quite a few years before we see inflation begin to kick that up.
Well, and Commissioner, that kind of leads into just a follow-on question, because if the governor's plan increases oil prices with inflation and as an assumption, which is something, I mean, how do we, Senator Torgerson is really trying to get at, I think you said it, how do the experts project out 20 years from now? And I'm not talking about staff. You have experts on staff, but how do outside experts project the price of oil over the next 20 years? I mean, it's a guessing game, but what are the types of measures used, if you know?
They do the same thing that we do in house, and that is make judgments about what the market is going to, what's going to happen in terms of demand, what's going to happen in response to the demand, where will the supply come from, what's going to happen technologically, and then you have to also factor in a political judgment, and that is what will OPEC and the countries that are currently cooperating with OPEC to limit the production volume do.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Commissioner, on this graph here, you must assume a production rate of X?
Yes.
Is it a fixed rate for each year, or do you bring it down with each of the outlying years?
The staff, you know, my own staff and the staff at the Department of Natural Resources have each done their own production projections, and it's done on a field-by-field basis, a judgment about when new fields will come into production.
So each of these markers here represents not only a change in the price, but also a change in production?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Torgerson.
Commissioner, are there any real major differences between your projections and DNR's on when fields are going to come online?
No. You know, we work closely with their staff to come up with the projections that we use for our revenue forecast. They come up with their own projections for a couple of different reasons. One, it's their job. Secondly, they have a responsibility for making a judgment about whether to take royalty oil in kind or in value. And in order to be able to make that judgment, they have to have a very firm idea, although they necessarily are going to be a little bit conservative about it, about how much oil is available to what the state might choose to take in kind.
One more question. Commissioner, NPRA sells May 5th, and I haven't seen in any of your projections or the governor's projections any revenue that might come to the state of Alaska from that sale. Can you tell us why that is, or if you are projecting a bonus to come into the general fund?
We have not included any of those amounts in our revenue projections.
Why is that?
Well, it's so hard to make a guess as to how much that might be. First of all, in terms of future production, we just don't make any guesstimates.
Are there more categories of success or failure that we may see, or will we zero in on these five?
Well, through the chair, Mr. Chairman. Actually, that's a good question, because our performance measures, which are on the, actually in your packet, that the Senate, we worked with the Senate on last year, are actually sort of a translation of these standards into outcomes. So, for instance, average length of time children who are taken into custody are spent in out-of-home care. We track that. That's an outcome measure as opposed to a measurement of work. And I think that's where the Senate was going last year in terms of performance. We think these work pretty well. And we'd like to add, interestingly enough, reports of harm are not on here. So we'd like to add that. And that would be my goal for measuring accountability and progress.
Senator Phillips, we're going to wrap this up in about 5 minutes. So go ahead, Senator.
Commissioner, have you hired a director for the Anchorage office yet?
For the Anchorage, for the chair, yes, I have.
Okay, when was that done?
October, we hired James Steele. We went through an interview process with a community team, and he was successful and doing well.
Was the office split into two different categories or job functions in the Anchorage office?
To the chair, Senator Phillips, we decided to pull Matt Sue and Kenai out of the Anchorage office. We went to four regions instead of three because we felt that neither region was getting adequate attention. And so Gladys Langdon is our manager for the South Central region, which includes the Chain and Kodiak and so on. And our MAPSU chief, Greg Van Kirk, is actually doing a lot more supervision also.
How long does it take to complete an investigation for reports of harm for the average social worker within the department?
I'd like to ask someone else to answer that.
Senator, I can't give you any specific average. I would say that it varies significantly. In some cases where you can go out in a very short order and assess the situation and determine there's no risk, it takes a very short time. Those cases that are complex, sexual abuse cases, for instance, involving multiple children, can take several days, and adding in the court work can increase that time. So an average is probably not a particularly useful measure.
Okay. Senator Kelly, say something else.
Most of the reports I suppose come from school districts. Last winter I met with some principals in Fairbanks, and they were very concerned about the number of reports of harm and the time of the road. And I think we had talked, Mr. Purdue, earlier in the year sometime about somehow connecting the vision with the education community. Has that happened more recently? Is that part of how you're
Senator Kelly, we'd like that to happen much more, and some places it is happening more. One of the things in House Bill 375 that was really important is teachers are mandatory reporters, and what happens is they call us, and then they don't know what's happening because we can't get back to them. We couldn't get back to them. So we have in this law a requirement that we get back to mandated reporters to tell them, you know, what happened. Because the teacher was sitting there with the child in the classroom, and you know, days would go by, and then they'd call again. So that's one issue. And yes.
What have you done towards that end?
We have not yet finalized our policy on that.
Yes, we have. Yes. Offices, either through writing, phone calls, or actually meeting, like in the MAPSU area, they meet once a month with the school district, and they go through all the reports that were submitted and what our actions were. It varies by office because of volume. But at a minimum, they get a letter saying what happened, what was the outcome of the investigation. In some cases, and what we hear from schools the most is that it's on the low-risk situations that they see, because they have kids in their every day that are, you know, coming hungry. And those are the kids who can't get here. So a lot of their concerns is placed down on the low-risk situation.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we've done, we got some money for a pilot project we're actually doing in the MAPSU called Dual Track, which is that a community agency will take the reports, some of the reports that we can't go out on, and actually go and talk to the family. And sometimes if the kids come to school hungry, it's that the parents are living in a place with no running water and, dirty, no running water, and you know, are clean jobs. And that's not a child protection matter at all. So we're trying to beef up our response to the lower level by using community agencies. And we have been doing that with the tribes and the military to some benefit also.
Just call but the actions you've taken, have they actually resulted in better contact and more investigation? What you said about meeting monthly and filling out reports about what were actually done, have been done in these cases, didn't naturally say that more had been investigated, which is maybe anything that has a result in that more had been investigated.
Senator Green?
Yeah, I was just wondering, on the breakdowns of the priorities, there's also noted the response time. And how would you assess your response based on 24-hour priority one, 72 hours, or 7 days on priority three?
Through the chair, Senator, I would say overall, the responses to the priority ones are pretty good. They're timely. They are, our staff are pretty well aware of how critical those responses are. We're probably a little less timely on the priority twos and on the priority threes, because those are the reports that are subject to the workload adjusting. It's clear that we're not as timely on those as we would like to be. The real critical issue is, you know, that we have to be able to respond to all of these, because we never know what the real situation is until we get on the ground in the home.
I would suggest then that this policy, if it's going to be a policy, you know, can't mean anything unless you are meeting the time constraints, and that would certainly be part of getting things on track to a greater degree. Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Related to that, Commissioner, just in wrap up here, does workload adjustment, I mean, does that represent a significant change in direction of policy for the administration, or is it something that you've been doing for years?
Mr. Chairman, it's something we've been doing for years. It's something we'd like to get out of doing, and we don't see that happening overnight given the constraints of the resources available. But it is something, as we do have a three-year plan in our budget that we've laid out that would get us to no more workload adjustments.
Was that part of last year's Smart Start legislation as well, and the budget request from last year?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My closing comment would be that it's been suggested that this audit was premature. I don't think the audit was premature. The auditing of this activity would never be premature. I think what we must caution ourselves is that drawing conclusions from this audit is premature. This was a huge effort on behalf of this administration, this legislature led by Representative Eisen, who's here today. And I think we all know how important this is. And while we must always be critical of this effort and be vigilant as legislators, I think at the same time I wouldn't want anyone to think that us being critical today is by any means an indication of our lack of support of this effort. I, for one, stand by to continue the work that many of you have done in this room. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, we're going to conclude this portion of the meeting and move into the balanced budget plan presentation. I appreciate you all joining us today. Thank you very much. And thank you, Kat, as well, for being here. There was people who were originally online apparently are not there and will not be able to testify today. So we do have some written testimony from one of them that's been distributed to the committee and made available to the public.
Now, Commissioner Condon, if you would join us. In, go ahead. Go ahead and sit down, Commissioner. In developing our long-range balanced budget plan, Senator Kelly, you guys, we're still in order. Commissioner, do you need any time to set up or pass out paperwork? Oh no, we've got committee staff to help you here. Let's just take a quick recess while the commissioner will get the paperwork passed.